napkin to notice that I was back. "Can you look the accident up on your phone?" I asked grimly as I input the second address into the GPS. "There should be an accident report or a news story." Dutifully, June performed a search with one hand while scratching Catherine's head with the other. "Died on Thursday, crossing Miller Avenue sometime after midnight," she read. "Struck by an unknown vehicle. There were no witnesses and no suspects." "That's convenient," I muttered. Odds were it was a legitimate accident, a drunk driver fleeing the scene, a kid joyriding in stolen wheels. Abby's death most likely was not suspicious, and yet it nagged at me. Loose ends. "Thursday," I said, opening a bottle of water and taking a long drink. I wish it were Mountain Dew. "Saturday is when they found that the dental records were a match."
"Are you suggesting that those events are connected?" June asked.
"I don't know. I don't see a connection, but that doesn't mean there isn't one." I drummed my fingers on the steering wheel in thought.
"Abby Gilbert had a court date for the fraud complaint brought by the Kendalls, but essentially she was no longer part of the story. Abby was unveiled as an opportunist, and now Callie is deceased. The missing person portion of the case is closed. Unless Abby was the one who committed the homicide, I failed to see her connection," June said.
I didn't have an inkling either. Maybe someone was worried that the press would come asking more questions once the remains were identified. Like, how did Abby convince the Kendalls that she was Callie? Wouldn't someone be wondering how she fooled them?
Perhaps. But why wait until now? Why not run her down with a vehicle immediately after discovering she committed fraud? And are you insinuating that you believe the Kendalls have some responsibility in Callie's death?
I'm not insinuating anything, I promised. I'm just not positive that one of them didn't have something to do with her death. The sun did little to warm the chill developing in my body as I steered onto the highway and headed southwest. It was too convenient, Abby's death. The one person who could answer questions about exactly why the Kendalls accepted her as Callie was gone. And I certainly wasn't about to walk up to Judge Kendall and demand an explanation.
Let's walk through this. What if the Kendalls knew she wasn't Callie? I said. That theory makes no sense. Why would they publicly perpetuate the myth that their daughter had been found?
I bit my lip, considering. I remembered those cool gray eyes and shivered. Judge Kendall is up for appointment to a federal judgeship, I said.
A big deal, right?
It is a prestigious position, June agreed.
A lot of power, prestige. He wouldn't want to jeopardize that, right? He wouldn't want anything from his past coming to light that would cast doubt on his character.
Investigators always look at the family first. It's standard procedure, she reminded me. Judge Kendall was never named as a suspect or a person of interest.
Could anyone cover their tracks that well?
Your expression suggests you are angry, she said.
This is my thinking face, I explained.
Where are we going now? She asked.
North Bethesda, I told her. There's another person who might have some insight into the Kendalls' relationship with their daughter.
What makes you think there was an issue in the relationship?
June asked, fishing in the bag at her feet and pulling out the other half of her turkey sandwich.
I can't explain it. It's just a hunch, a feeling in my gut.
I've met a lot of families, a lot of dysfunctional families, and the Kendalls are ringing that bell for me.
I do not hear a bell, she said.
I smiled. I loved the literal mind of June Tucker.
You're a fact girl, aren't you, June? I rely heavily on facts, she agreed as she chewed a bite of sandwich.
As a researcher, I too have to rely on facts, but in my line of work, it was essential to develop instincts as well. And my instincts are telling me that there's something off about this entire situation.
But nothing you discover will change the fact that Callie is dead.
June had me there.
If I can find information that will give the Bodines any hope at all that their father was not involved in Callie Kendall's murder, I intend to do it.
That makes sense. It's our duty as friends to ease their suffering.
Then let's find some answers for them.
Perhaps your instincts are rooted in fact, she suggested. I was certain there was something false about Abby Gilbert's story, but was unsure what the falsehood was until I did my research.
Then let's do a little research in Bethesda, I said.
What is in Bethesda?
The junior high music teacher who reported signs of suspected child abuse involving Callie Kendall in 1998.
June frowned. My research did not uncover any such report, she said.
It was sealed and recanted, I explained. It took some digging, and the case file is basically empty. The only thing that exists is the date, the accuser's first and last name, and her written retraction. I really owed Leah May for her social media research skills.
If this teacher recanted her concerns, that means she was wrong, June frowned.
We're just tying up loose ends, I assured her. It's probably nothing. Let's go into this with an open mind. In my time as a social worker in Pittsburgh, I had seen a lot. Not everything, but enough to know that people were capable of just about anything, including filing false abuse and neglect reports. I'd seen angry exes file reports of child abuse against their former spouses just to get back at them. I'd also seen well-meaning people with genuine concerns file complaints only to have the investigation show the claims were baseless. In those situations, relationships were damaged, reputations tarnished. But someone at some point looked at Callie Kendall and wondered if someone was hurting or neglecting her. And June and I were going to ask that woman some questions. We took a break at a rest stop and let the dog and pig stretch their legs. Both pig and puppy drew a crowd of admirers before we got back in the car and headed south into North Bethesda. C.C. Benefiel retired from teaching in Richmond and moved to Maryland to be closer to her children. It also made her conveniently closer to us. North Bethesda was tidier than Abby Gilbert's town, wide sidewalks crisscrossed under canopies of neatly trimmed trees. Red brick buildings lined the trash-free streets. Everything felt well-maintained and proud. I followed the GPS directions, and 20 minutes later, we pulled up in front of a dull gold split-level home. The yard was maintained by an avid gardener, I guessed. Tall spikes of wildflowers and grasses exploded out of tidy flower beds. The grass was jade green and cut in a crosshatch pattern that spoke of pride and precision.
This is much more pleasant than the last place we attempted to sneak into, June observed. Does this music teacher know that we are coming?
I shook my head. I didn't want to scare her off with some cryptic message asking questions about a children and youth report she filed 20-odd years ago.
That was probably wise, she said, adjusting her ball cap. Do you suppose I will still have the opportunity to play bad cop?
I laughed.
I hope so. I'd love to see it.
We left the car running, the air conditioning cranked, and crossed the street. We followed a winding walk through azaleas and tall, fluffy grasses to the front porch. I reached for the bell, but June stopped me.
If this music teacher is also deceased, then I will start to share your suspicions.
Let's hope that's not the case. 41. Shelby. Mrs. C.C. Benefiel was very much alive and thrilled to have the company. Especially once I told her we were interviewing retired teachers for a grad school project. Fortunately, the woman didn't catch June's "no, we're not" as she ushered us inside. Her husband, Mr. Benefiel, was on a 3-day golf trip with two of their adult sons and 3 grandsons, she explained. She insisted that she was always happy to talk to fellow lovers of education. I took the information dump as a hopeful sign that she was an oversharer. She was just what I would have wanted in a music teacher, bubbly, with short, fluffy hair, reading glasses worn on a chain, and bright smile that insisted we were welcome. My junior high music teacher, Mr. Hendricks, by contrast, was a balding, angry 50-something going through a divorce and taking it out on his students. I felt a tiny stab of guilt at misrepresenting our reason for being there, but managed to shove it aside. We were on a mission. Also, it was almost worth it just hearing June introduce us as July and Sheila. I promise we won't take up too much of your time, I told her as she led us into her living room. It was cozy and crowded with furniture that looked as if it had been heavily used and well tended for at least a decade.
I imagined some of the half-dozen grandchildren in frames adorning the wallpapered walls enjoyed bouncing on the overstuffed sofa and mismatched but equally comfy armchairs. This was the home of someone who appreciated and enjoyed family.
"It is no trouble at all, Sheila. I'm thrilled to have some company," Mrs. Benefiel insisted. "I was just about to make some tea. Would you like some?"
"Do you have any cookies?" June asked. I elbowed her.
"Of course I have cookies," Mrs. Benefiel beamed. "I'll be right back."
The woman disappeared toward the back of the house, and I could hear the sounds of a kettle being readied. "That was not very polite," June said, rubbing her ribs.
"We're here for information, not snacks."
"George is on a diet, which means I am on a diet. George isn't here, so I can have cookies. Grandma's make the best cookies."
Her logic was flawless. "Eat as many of them as you can before I tell her why we're really here."
"You got us invited inside on false pretenses. I'll accept snacks on false pretenses," she said. "How will you broach the subject of Callie Kendall?"
I shrugged. "I haven't gotten that far yet." I hoped she would provide an opening for me. I didn't feel good about being booted from an elderly school teacher's very nice home. Mrs. Benefiel returned carrying a tea tray.
"Do either of you two mind dogs?" she asked.
"Not at all. We both enjoy pets," June said.
"Oh, wonderful. Then you won't mind if Scout joins us. Scout, come."
I heard the thunder of what was way too big to be paws tearing down the hall. Pictures in the frames rattled on the wall. Knickknacks on shelves trembled. The beast that loped into the room wasn't a dog as much as a bull, an elephant, a rhinoceros. She was tall and leggy with blue-gray fur. Her ears were perked up over one blue eye and one brown.
"There's my sweet little girl," Mrs. Benefiel crooned.
Scout sat on her haunches and remained at my eye level.
"She's a Great Dane."
"My pig is in the car," June announced. Mrs. Benefiel blinked behind her glasses.
"I'm sorry, my dear. Did you say pig?"
"Yes. Her name is Marie Curie," June said. I blinked. June had just given her pig an alias. She dug her phone out of her back pocket. "Would you like to see some pictures?"
"Well, if she's in the car, why don't you bring her inside?" Mrs. Benefiel suggested, putting her reading glasses on to better admire June's pig.
"Sheila's puppy is in the car as well," June mentioned.
"Oh, Scout loves puppies," our hostess exclaimed.
While I was trying to discern whether she meant Scout loved puppies for breakfast or as playmates, June trotted outside to retrieve our pets. 5 minutes later, a pig, a dog, and a horse, because there was no way Scout was a dog, were chasing each other all over the first floor of Mrs. Benefiel's home while June and I drank green tea and ate freshly iced sugar cookies.
"Now, tell me about this project of yours, Sheila and July," Mrs. Benefiel insisted.
Scout tore through the living room, chased by an ecstatic Billy Ray. Catherine trotted through at a more leisurely pace.
"Mrs. Benefiel, I'm sure you've taught hundreds of children over the years," I began. "I'm sure you had a few favorites."
June grabbed a second cookie. Mrs. Benefiel chuckled.
"Well, now, dear, we try not to have favorites. But there are always a few students every year that stand out."
"How many years did you teach?" I asked.
32 years, and nearly every day was a delight."
"I imagine you've seen it all in your career," I ventured. "Good and bad."
"Oh, certainly,"
she nodded, her glasses swinging on the chain around her neck.
"Teaching is more than just rules and grades and summers off. We're peacekeepers and protectors, too."
That was my opening. I went for it, swinging for the fences.
"Do you remember Callie Kendall?"
I asked. A flicker of wariness danced across her face, and her teacup trembled on its saucer in her lap.
"What kind of project is this?" she asked, softer this time.
Billy Ray chose that moment to trot into the room, proudly dragging a 6-foot-long stuffed snake toy.
Scout was on the other end of the snake, putting up a good show of playing tug. I hoped my sweet puppy's antics assured her that I wasn't an enemy. Mrs. Benefiel, I am in grad school, but I also have a license in social work. I know that you filed a complaint with Henrico County Children's Services in 1998. She set her cup and saucer down with a definitive snap.
I made a mistake, she said, coming to her feet. A terrible, terrible mistake, and I told the authorities that.
That was fear etched on her face. Stark fear caused by some unknown threat. I rose. June's hand snaked out for another cookie, sensing our visit was coming to an abrupt end.
Mrs. Benefiel, I think that maybe you weren't wrong, I said softly. I don't know what happened, but I think you saw something, and you were right to report it.
She was a good girl, bright and sweet, so quiet. But she came alive in music class. She loved music of all kinds,
Mrs. Benefiel said, her hands bunching into fists at her sides.
But I was wrong.
June stood up, too.
I am confused by this conversation. You say you were wrong, but you are acting as though you are supposed to say that you are wrong.
Are you working for him? She whispered, eyes glistening. Because I haven't done anything wrong. I did what I said I would. I kept my promises.
Who, Mrs. Benefiel? Who are you afraid of? We aren't working for anyone. No one knows we're here.
He knows. Or he will, she said flatly.
I promise that no one knows we're here. We came because our friend's father is a person of interest in her murder.
Callie Kendall deserved better than what she got in this life, Mrs. Benefiel said, her voice shaking. Now, please leave.
We can help you, I said earnestly. If you need help, we can figure it out together. She shook her head.
No, please go.
I'm very sorry for upsetting you, I said, gathering my purse.
Garth, Marie Curie, June called. Come.
Pig and puppy jogged into the room, tails wagging. She showed us to the door, tension in every movement.
I'm sorry, I can't help you.
Her eyes implored me. And then she was looking past me and at the family photos on the wall behind me. 42. Shelby. After terrifying an elderly woman in her own home that we gained entrance to under false pretenses, I felt like I'd done enough damage for the day. We headed home with our exhausted pets, immune to the terror their mommies unintentionally inflicted, snoozing in the back seat.
I have concerns that Mrs. Benefiel was not being completely honest, June said, polishing off the last bite of cookie.
I have similar concerns, I agreed, merging onto the highway and pointing us in the direction of Bootleg Springs.
Who is the him she asked about? Perhaps we should turn around and go back and ask for clarification.
I think she's probably had enough questions for today.
Perhaps I don't read people with any consistency, but I felt her physiological reactions point toward fear, she said, frowning out her window.
Someone besides us scared Mrs. Benefiel, and I think it was tied to that Children's Services report, I said grimly. I thought of Judge Kendall again, those flat, cool gray eyes. Was he capable of aggression? Of violence? And if so, could he inflict both on his own daughter? The sigh escaped me in a whoosh.
Are you having difficulty breathing? June asked.
No, I'm feeling frustrated. I expected to come home with at least a few answers instead of just more questions.
And what did we find out? We discovered that the woman who impersonated Callie Kendall, bilking the Kendalls out of money and an apartment, is now deceased. And the accident remains unsolved, she summarized. Then we questioned Mrs. Benefiel, who perpetuated the existing story, that she made a report and then immediately recanted it.
Yep. That's what we found out,
I agreed, feeling tired and frustrated. I'd forgotten lunch and now wasn't even hungry. My phone rang and I winced when I saw the readout on the screen. Jonah. I hit the ignore button. We should probably decide on what we're going to tell Jonah and GT about where we were today, I told June. She blinked and frowned at me. That we went to Baltimore to question Abby and found her deceased. Then we drove to Mrs. Benefield's home, where Catherine and Billy Ray got to play with her Great Dane while we questioned her about the sealed child services report.
We can't tell them that.
Why not? It's the truth.
Do you always tell GT the truth?
I didn't know if I was more nervous about Jonah or my brother discovering how we'd spent our day. Of course. What's the point of being in a relationship if you feel it necessary to tell falsehoods? She asked, looking at me as if I'd just suggested that math was stupid and shouldn't be taught in schools anymore.
Well, I
didn't know what to say to that.
It wasn't that I didn't trust Jonah, was it?
Of course not. He was a good guy. I was just trying to avoid his judgment over what might be deemed questionable behavior. I didn't want to have the argument that would undoubtedly unfold when I explained that I stuck my nose into an investigation without trusting law enforcement to do their due diligence.
Oh, hell, I whispered. I was doing exactly what he'd called me out for doing. Hiding things from people I cared about so I didn't have to face their reactions or defend myself. I didn't think I'd done anything truly wrong today, besides upsetting Mrs. Benefield. I felt terrible about that, and I was planning on sending her a nice fruit basket or maybe a pizza gift certificate as an apology.
You shouldn't be dishonest with Jonah, June said, pulling her ball cap off and stuffing it into her purse. She didn't bother looking in the mirror to fix her hair.
I know.
I did know. But old habits were hard to break. Sometimes men surprise you in delightful ways, she said. Sometimes they accept you for exactly who you are. But the only way you can discover that kind of relationship is by behaving authentically.
Oh, June, I sighed. You're a good friend.
Yes, I am.
I cracked a smile. Maybe it was time to stop shutting everyone out. I was 30 years old and this close to a doctorate. I shouldn't spend my time worrying about having to defend my decisions. If Jonah didn't like who I was, then he was welcome to move on and find someone else less curious, less rash, less creaky in the joints. I gripped the steering wheel a little tighter. I had to trust Jonah to accept me. I owed that to him.
I feel that we should bring our findings to my father's attention, June announced as I pulled into her driveway.
Catherine, sensing she was home, woke with a snort. Part of me wanted to retain ownership of the research, but a slightly smarter part recognized that it was a better choice to turn things over to Sheriff Tucker and let him pass them up the chain of command. If my concerns were dismissed, then I'd be free to continue my own investigation.
I think that's a good idea, June. How about I go home and talk to Jonah? Then we can go see your dad at the station?
That will be acceptable.
June and Catherine got out and headed into the house. I spent the 5-minute drive home practicing what I'd say to Jonah.
Hey, so you know how I said I was taking Billy Ray on a play date with June and Catherine? Well, instead, I took everyone on a road trip to interrogate the Callie Kendall impersonator, who, by the way, is conveniently dead as of Thursday, and a really sweet retired music teacher who I'm pretty sure cried after we left. What's for dinner?
Billy Ray propped his paws up on the console and yipped.
It's just a first draft, I explained to the dog.
Uh-oh, Daddy's home. I pulled in behind Jonah's car. He was stretching on the front porch, taking hits from a water bottle. He looked up, grinned, waved. My heart did a little thump hop in my chest. Just physical attraction, I told myself, just appreciating the fine male form.
Hey there, cutie pie, he said, descending the stairs to meet me in the driveway.
He brushed his mouth over mine in a sweet, lazy kiss. My cheeks flushed with heat.
I couldn't tell if I was nervous about coming clean or if it was something else. Something about coming home to Jonah Bodine, who called me Cutie Pie and kissed me in the front yard. "Hi," I said breathlessly.
"There's my buddy,"
Jonah said, kneeling down to rough up Billy Ray's ears. The puppy looked about as smitten as I felt. Oh, boy. I was in serious trouble.
"We were invited to dinner with your parents, drinks at Jameson and Leah May's, and out on a double date with my mom and, God help us all, Jimmy Bob Prosser,"
he announced, scooping the puppy up under one arm and slinging his free arm over my shoulders, steering me toward the house.
"Oh?"
Since we'd initiated our physical relationship, we'd gotten awfully popular.
"I told them all we were busy," he said.
"You did? What are we busy doing?"
"Besides spending the evening fighting over what I'm about to tell you."
"Each other,"
he said with a devilish wink. His hand skimmed my bare arm, and my sensible underwear dissolved.
"Before we,
participate in that particular activity, we do have to do something fully clothed and socially, necessary."
Scarlet, has anyone talked to Gibbs lately?
Bowie, Gibbs who?
Jameson,
does Gibbs willingly talk to anyone?
Jonah,
haven't heard from him since the cookout.
Scarlet,
I'm getting annoyed with the hermit routine. Y'all think he's wallowing?
Bowie,
I'll give him a call and obnoxiously pump him for information. I need a favor from him anyway.
Scarlet,
bless your Bodine heart. Let me know if the grumpy bastard needs anything.
43. Jonah. I took it as well as I could, mindful that this was very likely some kind of Shelby test. So my girlfriend took our dog, our friend, and our friend's pig on an investigation road trip because she was convinced she had a lead that investigators had ignored for 13 years, and now she needed to go to the sheriff and explain what she'd found. I took another cleansing breath. "Do I have time for a shower?" I asked. Shelby blinked. She'd been twisting her hands together and biting the corner of her bottom lip.
Yeah, sure,
she said. "Okay, why don't you grab a snack while I shower and change?"
"Yeah, great, sure. Wait."
She grabbed me when I started for the stairs.
"You don't seem mad."
"I'm not." I wasn't really mad. Mad wasn't the right word. Concerned, annoyed, extremely cognizant of the fact that if I launched into a lecture on what she should have done, I'd be reinforcing the concern she had about sharing information with people who cared about her. Nothing good would come from me blowing up at her. So I gave her a smile and a gentle shove in the direction of the kitchen. "See you in a few." I dashed up the stairs and stripped in the bathroom. My face was under the stream of tepid water when the door burst open.
"I'm not buying this not mad thing," she announced, waving a yogurt cup at me. "I did something a little bit on the stupid side today, and you're fine with it?"
I turned to face her. "Stupid is a little harsh, don't you think?" I said mildly. Her gaze traveled down my body, lingering on the interesting parts. Not wanting to miss out on the conversation, Billy Ray trotted in behind her and sat down on the bath mat.
"I tried to track down a known con artist and then intimidated a really nice older lady because I had a hunch."
"From the sounds of it, your hunch has some basis to it." I ducked my head back under the water to rinse the shampoo. She watched me for almost an entire minute, eyes narrowed and calculating. I twisted off the faucet and stepped out. In the bathroom the size of a postage stamp, we were almost touching. I reached around her for a towel and heard her intake of breath.
"I know what you're doing,"
she said, spooning yogurt into her mouth, her expression a picture of suspicion.
What am I doing besides drying off? You're proving to me that telling the truth to people I care about doesn't necessarily have to have the consequences I fear.
Smart, smart girl. Is that what I'm doing? I asked innocently.
Jonah!
Shelby!
I'd rather you be honest with me, she said. Then she laughed. Oh, darn you, June Tucker, she muttered.
You'd rather I be honest? I repeated.
Yes!
It looked like Shelby's answer surprised her, and that took the edge off my frustration.
I was honest with you, now it's your turn. Jonah, I took our puppy and our friend, plus a pig, on a road trip with the intention of interrogating two strangers, one of which was under investigation for fraud until she mysteriously ended up dead. Then I made a grandma cry after taking cookies from her under false pretenses.
At least you didn't go alone, I said mildly.
Jonah Bodine!
She stomped her foot, and Billy Ray let out a joyful bark, certain it was a game. Shelby Thompson.
What do you want me to say? The truth. What are you thinking right now? I'm thinking that I'm glad you grabbed a yogurt instead of some garbage candy for your snack. I'm thinking you look so pretty right now that it's hard to concentrate on how much I want to yell at you. Thank you. Go ahead and yell, she shouted.
I obliged.
What in the hell were you thinking, Shelby? Do you have any idea what could have happened to you or June? That con artist could have been more than a fraud, and you know it. She could have been dangerous. It was irresponsible, and you should have told me. You could have talked me into going with you. You know I would have. You would have tried to talk me out of it and then complained the whole time about what a dumb idea it was. That's exactly what I would have done,
I agreed at full volume.
I really like you. Your opinion matters to me. I didn't want you disappointed that I couldn't just let this go or hand it off. It was a sealed record, but someone with the right authority had to have looked at it and disregarded it. I felt that there was something there, and I wanted to find out.
I understand that, I yelled back.
And I like you too, a lot. That's why it matters to me when you do something rash without cluing me in. I'm here because I care about you. So don't do more stupid shit without at least talking me into supporting you first. Got it? Fine. This is the healthiest fight I've ever had in my entire adulthood,
she admitted, lowering her voice almost to normal conversation level.
This is adulthood. Kind of makes you wonder how your family would react if you finally told them about your health, doesn't it?
I shot back.
Stop distracting me with your dancing pectorals and put some clothes on.
Shelby insisted. She turned for the door. Billy Ray looked forlorn, like he couldn't decide which parent to stay with. She paused.
And I'm going to tell them. After my triathlon.
Aren't they going home before then? I asked, already knowing the answer.
A phone call works just as well as face-to-face,
she sniffed.
Does it?
I made my pecs dance. Shelby's gaze was drawn hypnotically to my chest. She shook her head and turned her back on me.
Please put some clothes on and come with me to the sheriff's office.
Not much in this world riled the sheriff of Bootleg Springs. It came with the badge. Harlan Tucker was a calm man used to soothing frayed feelings, smoothing over rough edges. But hearing his daughter's admission that she willingly hunted down a known fraud had him blinking rapidly for almost a minute straight. George handled it less subtly. His big frame was slumped in a chair in the station's conference room, a meaty hand over his eyes. The room smelled of stale coffee and old pastries.
I can't believe my sister and my girlfriend thought they'd just take the law into their own hands, George moaned.
Again! June patted him on the shoulder.
Let's focus on the part where Shelby and I believe we've uncovered important information regarding the investigation into Callie Kendall's murder.
Sheriff Tucker stroked a hand over his white mustache. Hmm, he said. I felt a little sorry for the man who was being forced to walk the line between family and the law.
So, what do we do next?
Shelby asked next to me. I saw the sheriff's nearly imperceptible flinch at the we part of that question.
We are going to pass this information on to the investigators, he began, holding up a hand when both June and Shelby started to argue. And we are going to impress upon them that some of these details might bear consideration.
Shelby sat back and crossed her arms.
In other words, you want us to mind our business.
Shelby, I appreciate your initiative, he decided, choosing the word carefully. And I certainly believe that this information needs to be relayed through the appropriate channels. But I would be remiss if I didn't strongly encourage you all to bring your concerns directly to law enforcement. It's what we're here for. It's job security for me.
You will look into Abby's death, won't you? Shelby pressed.
I certainly will. I promise you that, the sheriff agreed.
Good. George and I need to get back to our pig,
June announced, rising.
Sheriff, if you don't mind another request from me, Shelby said. I think someone intimidated Mrs. Benefield into recanting her claim, someone that she is still afraid of. If you do speak to her, can you do it very quietly?
Sheriff Tucker nodded.
I will definitely do that, he promised.
Some of the tension left Shelby's shoulders.
Okay, good. Thank you for your time,
she said. We rose and started for the door.
I'm telling Mom and Dad, George said, pointing a long finger at Shelby.
She scrunched her nose up at him, but didn't argue.
Gee, Shelby, you sure are working hard to win the most memorable summer fling, I told her, slinging my arm around her as we stepped out into the night, thick with humidity.
All part of my master plan to make sure you never forget me.
44. Shelby. I rolled my shoulders and adjusted the volume on Salt and Peppa as they warbled 90s vibes in my ears. It was early evening, and I was nearing the end of my allotted work hours. I still had a 10-mile bike ride to squeeze in. Working my way through the most recent survey responses, I'd had 936 so far. I was slowly crafting a structure for my paper, one that felt as organic yet cohesive as the responses I was getting. I still felt like something was missing, that the key was somehow in the next response or the next, but overall, I was finally making real progress. I shot a glance at the vase of wildflowers behind my laptop. Jonah. He'd picked them up at a little stand in the park yesterday and brought them home for me. Going for that most memorable summer fling notoriety. He made it so easy to appreciate him. To fall for him. I grinned at the whimsical flowers, the chipped pitcher we'd found in the kitchen, and turned back to the next survey. Question: What factors make you feel as if you belong here as part of the community? Jonah Bodine.
A few months ago, I would have said I didn't necessarily belong, that I was just passing through. That the only thing keeping me here was the family I was getting to know. But that's not the case. I came for the family, stayed for the family. Then something strange started to happen. I wasn't just new in town anymore. I wasn't just a gossip item or an oddity. I was providing a service, meeting a need. The more I gave to this town, the more they gave me in return. I was alone when I came to Bootleg Springs. But I'm not alone now. I have new family, new friends, interesting clients, a roommate that I can't stop thinking about, and a dog. Somehow, I accidentally built an entire life here without noticing that I was planting roots. I think part of it is good-natured conspiracy. My family wants me to stay. This town wants me to stay. Every connection I make here binds me tighter to the community. Every class I teach, every client I help, is one more root planted. Every bonfire, every kiss, every beer or pepperoni roll or day on the water makes Bootleg Springs more a part of my life. And I don't know if I want to fight it anymore.
My heart did an agreeable little tap dance as several stimuli worked on my system simultaneously. The woman in me swooned just the tiniest bit at Jonah's admission that he couldn't stop thinking about me. The data nerd tap danced at the fact that he'd willingly filled out the survey. Attacking me from my romantic and analytical sides in one fell swoop, I approved. What made the researcher in me push back from my chair and do a little boogie was the idea of the levels of assimilation. It wasn't just one group, like a church or an office full of co-workers, that did the heavy lifting when it came to providing a sense of belonging. Bootleg Springs was an organism that used multiple prongs of attack. You weren't only welcome at Moonshine Diner or just Yeehaw Yarn and Coffee. You were welcome in the park, the church, the police station, Sally Mae Brickman's kitchen table. They called you by name in the pop-in and were happy to see you at Build-A-Shine. Jimmy Bob Prosser remembered what kind of a dishwasher you had in your kitchen when you came into the hardware store. The entire town worked together to entice and welcome and infiltrate every aspect of residents' lives, until there was no boundary between the individual and the society. I envisioned vines, all sprouting from the same place, all wriggling and stretching and winding their way in and around the society, binding everyone and everything together. Jonah Bodine had just unlocked my entire thesis, removed the block, turned the angel chorus on in my head. He'd also just inserted a key directly into my heart, and I wasn't surprised at all. I pirouetted, startling Billy Ray, who barked himself awake from under the table. I picked up the puppy, swooping him into the air in a circle. He wriggled with joy. "Billy Ray, your daddy is a genius, and your mommy is going to get her doctorate. Dr. Mommy!" I set him on the ground and tossed a ball for him. He tore after it, little feet scrabbling on the floor. A glance at my watch told me I needed to leave now to get my 10 miles in if I didn't want to do the entire ride in the dark. Good. Exercise seemed to juggle everything that swam in my head into neat and tidy boxes. A nice summer evening bike ride would give me a chance to figure out exactly how to make Jonah's answer the center of it all. With Billy Ray mournfully ensconced in his crate with a handful of treats and his favorite stuffed bear toy, I pulled on my fluorescent green cycling shirt, clipped on my helmet, and set off on the route Jonah had programmed for me. The crickets were loud, and a few early fireflies lit up over the fields. A part of me couldn't believe that I, Shelby Thompson, was pedaling a bike over hill and dale in rural West Virginia. Not too many years ago, I'd been convinced that I needed to be in a city, working in the trenches with families and children in need. It was the most direct way to help. Yet even then, with that naive confidence in the cause, the work didn't sit well with me. I'd sit in my car, eyes closed, taking slow, deep breaths to work up the nerve to knock on doors I dreaded. I felt like a failure giving it up, but I also knew, after the attack, I couldn't knock on another door again. I hadn't exactly embraced the sense of failure. More like tucked it away and tried to think about anything and everything else. Research was safe, but it was also essential, and it brought me joy. Bright, exciting, nerd-like joy every time I dove into new data. It made me happy. Now,
I was on the very early side of accepting that being happy in my life was more important than fulfilling a duty I didn't feel cut out to perform. Maybe I didn't have to feel so guilty about not finding the meaning I'd expected social work to provide. Maybe doing what I enjoyed would still help make a difference in the world. I juggled gears and came out of my seat. Jonah had, of course, incorporated some of the hillier sections of road around Bootleg Springs. I kept an eye on my heart rate and my speed, but my mind was racing with all the ways I could thread Jonah's insight into my paper. I couldn't wait to talk to him about it. That wasn't something new. I looked forward to my time with him every day. I liked watching him cook, enjoyed playing with Billy Ray in the yard. He'd accidentally built a life, and I was part of it. Could I continue to be part of it? If Jonah was staying, could I stay too? The hair on my arms stood up. I needed to look into universities and nonprofits within driving distance. If Jonah was staying, if I was staying, if we wanted a future together. Well, it was a lot of ifs, but they excited me rather than terrified me. Headlights caught me from behind, and I moved to hug the edge of the road. I was a mile out of town on Mountain Road, where there was road, guardrail, and then nothing but a steep drop. I'd gotten more confident biking with traffic, but dusk had fallen, and the car wasn't making any attempt to pass me. I could feel it inching closer and closer. Maybe the driver didn't feel safe passing me on such a twisty stretch of road. I let off the brake and folded over the handlebars. Immediately, I picked up speed. So did the car. I broke out of the turn, pedaling like hell toward the lights of town. Something felt wrong. And yet, oh so familiar. I wanted to twist in my seat to look behind me, but I couldn't do that without falling and probably breaking my neck. The tiny mirror on my handlebars did nothing but reflect headlights. The road was flattening, my speed dropping. The angle of the headlights changed. Oh, thank God, I whispered. The car was going to pass me. But it didn't. It pulled alongside me. An older sedan, gray or dark blue, I couldn't tell in the dark. The front wheel was missing the hubcap. I couldn't see the driver. But they were riding the double yellow line, keeping pace with me. Did I know them? Was this just a joke? But nothing about this felt funny. I needed to get into town, needed to be around people, witnesses. The car swerved into my lane and then back again, too close for comfort. This wasn't a joke. I wasn't overthinking. I was in danger. I shifted gears again and focused on form. I didn't need to see the heart rate read out on my watch to know it was stratospheric. The car slid toward me again, claiming the lane, but there were streetlights now, people ahead. I heard music coming from the park. I ignored my instinct to turn down an alley and try to get away from the car. I needed to lure them closer, into the light and buzz of town. I needed to see who was behind the wheel. One block and the car slowed, sliding in behind me again. I pedaled like mad, bursting onto Main Street across from the park. There was a band in the gazebo. A summer night concert, I realized. The town square was crawling with people, and I felt tears of relief prick at my eyes. I chanced a glance over my shoulder. But the car was gone. I didn't feel any safer. Jumping off my bike, I pushed it over the curb and into the park, joining the throng of summertimers and residents. But someone was out there in the night, and I felt them watching me.
45. Jonah.
Hey, honey, how was your ride? I asked, answering the phone on the first ring. Gibson and I had just stopped wedding trellis construction for a root beer break. He'd magically reemerged from his self-imposed exile and demanded I drop everything to help with the woodworking project. It hadn't exactly been a fun evening, with Gibson's black mood hanging like a toxic fog between us, but I was here for it, as a good brother would be. He'd never been the happy-go-lucky type, but I'd also never seen him quite this broody before. Something was going on, but I hadn't been able to pry it out of him. "I'm fucking fine," was his answer to everything. It was, eventful, Shelby said. I slid off the stool in Gibbs's shop, cluing in on her shaky voice. What's wrong? What happened? Are you hurt? Gibson was already reaching for his truck keys. We both started for the door, not a word exchanged, but I noticed he'd shed the dark cloud as if it had never existed. I'm fine, she said, but I didn't like the nerves I heard in her voice. She was rattled. Where are you? Gibbs and I are coming to you.
I feel like a big baby, and it was probably nothing, just a stupid prank, but I wouldn't say no to some friendly faces. I'm in town, in the park near the gazebo.
I'll follow you in, Gibson said as I yanked open my car door. He locked the shop behind him, Bowie and Cassidy's wedding trellis still on its side inside. On my short but breakneck trip into town, I got most of the story out of her. I double-parked on the street, Gibson nipping into a space on a side street just behind me. I stayed on the phone with her until I spotted her in the crowd. She was standing under a lamp on the park path as if she didn't want to leave the protection of the light. I grabbed her and pulled her in for a hard hug to reassure her as much as myself. Are you okay?
Honestly, I'm probably overreacting. It just felt so familiar,
Shelby said. I could feel her heart pounding against me. Gibson plowed his way through the crowd, Jameson and George on his heels. What happened? George demanded. Are you okay? When she didn't put up a fuss about Gibbs pulling her brother into it, I realized just how scared she'd been. Shelby ran through it again. I kept her tucked under my arm and scanned the crowd, looking for anyone who seemed out of place.
I think they pulled out behind me from Chestnut Road, she said. There was a car sitting there when I rode by. It almost felt like they were waiting for me.
You would know, George said, reaching out to squeeze her hand.
What are we missing?
Jameson asked, a frown furrowing his forehead. George, why don't you fill them in? I'm going to take Shelby and get some water, I told him. He nodded. Shelby stayed cuddled up against me, and to the outsider, we looked like a young couple in love just enjoying the starry summer night. I grabbed bottles of water for both of us, and then on second thought, bought two moonshines from the stand. Here, I said, holding both beverages out in offering. She gave me the ghost of a smile and went straight for the moonshine.
Thanks.
She coughed as it burned down her throat. Are you sure you're okay? I pressed.
Physically, yes, but mentally, Abby is dead, Jonah, and someone scared that Mrs. Benefield half to death. What if they found out that I was asking questions?
I'd been considering the same possibility, and I didn't like it. Shelby, honey, I think we should go to the police. I expected a denial, an argument, and when I didn't immediately get one, I pulled her in for another hug. Resting my chin on the top of her head, I wrapped my arms around her. No one was going to get to her, not without going through me.
I'm willing to talk to the police, she said, especially if it makes them take the rest of it more seriously.
She took another drink of the moonshine.
Jonah, what if I did this? What if I stirred this up and someone thinks they need to take care of Mrs. Benefield now? She has kids, grandkids.
Let's call the sheriff, I said firmly. We returned to the Bodines and George, Bowie had arrived with Cassidy in tow. She was in civilian clothes, her new engagement ring winking on her left hand, but her pretty face was all business.
"Let's go somewhere we can talk," she said, putting her arm around Shelby and leading her away.
"I don't like this," George said as the rest of us started after them. Scarlett, leading Devlin, appeared out of the crowd.
"What in the hell happened? Is Shelby okay?"
News in Bootleg traveled almost as fast as it did within the Bodine ranks. "Cassidy has her," I explained. "Why don't you two go sit with her?" I wanted Shelby surrounded by people. I wanted to make it impossible for a stranger to get within 20 feet of her. I needed to move my car. I needed to go find this son of a bitch and rearrange his face. I needed to glue myself to her side. "Gray or blue sedan, missing the front passenger side hubcap," I muttered.
"You stick with Shelby," Gibson said. "GT, move the car. Jameson and I are going to do a few laps around downtown looking for this asshole."
"If you find him, you'll call me?" I said.
"You'll get the first crack at his face," Gibson promised me.
"Dibs on what's left over,"
George called over his shoulder as he jogged toward where my truck was backing up traffic. I nodded and clapped my brother on the shoulder. "Thank you."
"Go be with your girl," Gibson said, shrugging off the thanks. It was good to have family.
Cassidy was just wrapping up her questions when I got to them. Shelby looked relieved to see me, and I elbowed Scarlett out of the way to get to her.
"Hey,"
she complained.
"Do you know of anyone who might want to hurt you?"
Cassidy asked, tucking her notebook into the back pocket of her shorts.
"The only person I can think of is whoever ran down Abby Gilbert or whoever intimidated Mrs. Benefiel into retracting her claim that Callie Kendall was being abused in junior high,"
Shelby said. She didn't sound scared now. She sounded downright pissed off.
"The girl who pretended to be Callie is dead?"
Scarlett screeched.
"Don't look at me like that," Cassidy insisted. "Dad just told me this afternoon."
"I need to call June," George said, tossing me my keys. "Make sure she's okay."
Gibson and Jameson jogged up.
"We saw a dark gray four-door sitting about a block down,"
Jameson reported.
"But when Gibbs started running toward it, looking like he was going to bust open the windshield, the driver pulled a U-ey and peeled out of here."
So he'd been waiting and watching. I pulled Shelby a little closer.
"What's with you, man?"
Jameson asked Gibson.
"You look like you're ready to either get up and murder someone or give up and pray for the good Lord to take you now."
Jameson's phone rang, saving Gibson from having to answer.
"Leah May,"
Jameson said. George was on his phone, plugging one ear. Shelby's phone rang.
"Dang it, which one of you big mouths told my parents?"
My phone vibrated next. It was my mother calling. News traveled fast. Sheriff Tucker appeared in full uniform, a face etched with concern.
"Why don't we all go someplace a little less chaotic and talk this through?" he suggested.
We descended on the Tucker house. The sheriff felt like privacy was more important than professionalism in this case. June arrived shortly after with her pot-bellied pig on a leash. In a much-appreciated moment of empathy, she'd swung by our place and picked up Billy Ray, who was snuggled up in Shelby's lap in the Tucker dining room while Nadine made tea and put out a buffet of snacks. The lights, the crowd of friendly faces, it all seemed to calm Shelby down. I, on the other hand, was so angry I could feel it vibrating in my bones. Sheriff Tucker, with help from June, filled everyone else in on the now infamous road trip and what they discovered.
"I don't know if this is connected," Shelby said, If it's not, it's an awfully big coincidence that once I start poking around into this case file and the Callie Kendall impersonator, someone just happens to decide to play cat and mouse with me on Mountain Road.
I noticed my brothers and sister sharing a quiet look. Mountain Road was where their mother had lost her life when her car went through a guardrail. Until recently, it had been thought to be an accident.
Look, I know it sounds all conspiracy theory-like,
Shelby said when silence descended around the table.
And I know that we don't have proof, but how many coincidences have to occur before we start asking questions?
Sheriff Tucker leaned back in his chair. I passed the information along to the investigators, he began. They said they'd look into it.
Bullshit, Devlin muttered under his breath.
I also decided to reach out to the Bethesda authorities and raised some concerns with them,
the sheriff continued.
They were pretty interested. Went to her house to pay her a visit. A neighbor told them Mrs. Benefiel and her dog left with suitcases at around 4 yesterday afternoon.
That is approximately 30 minutes after we left, June said. Another coincidence?
Shelby snorted.
And at around midnight last night, the Bethesda authorities got a series of calls of suspicious activity at the Benefiel house. Seems the neighbors keep a close watch on each other and noticed two people ringing the doorbell and peering in windows. They were gone by the time authorities arrived on the scene.
Shelby's hand tightened in mine. So, we've got an unsolved vehicular homicide, suspicious activity at a retired teacher's home, and now someone trying to chase Shelby down in a car the day after she goes looking for the dead girl and the teacher,
Cassidy summarized.
That's more than coincidental.
What we've got is a whole lot of suspicion and not one scrap of solid evidence,
Sheriff Tucker said. What do we do? I asked.
We remain watchful, he said, his eyes skimming every face around the table until he got a nod out of each one of us. We stay together. We let the police do their job.
Where did Mrs. Benefiel go? Shelby asked.
We tracked her to a golf resort in South Carolina. Seems her husband and some family are there now.
They need to be warned, she insisted.
Already have been, and authorities are watching the house.
I can't just sit back and wait, Shelby insisted. She got a lot of agreeing nods from everyone else, including Nadine.
If these events are connected to Callie Kendall's murder, Sheriff Tucker said, we can't afford to let word get out and have a whole town gossiping about the possibilities. Whoever is behind all of this is already nervous. And because of that, I can't have you, young lady,
he pointed at Shelby,
or you, Junebug, doing any more digging. Do I make myself clear?
As long as you and everyone else involved is taking this seriously,
Shelby said, stroking a hand over Billy Ray's silky ear.
This is bullshit, Gibson snapped.
I couldn't help but agree with him.
46. Shelby. At first, being surrounded by people was entertaining. But the suffocating Shelby watch soon began to take its toll. Not only was I never alone, but Jonah and I were never alone either. News of the incident on Mountain Road had spread. No one outside the Bodine, Tucker, and Thompson clans knew that there might be more to it than a stupid, dangerous prank. But within our ranks, everyone was aware and vigilant, and very, very present. Babysitting me seemed to have become a new Bootleg Springs pastime. I was looking forward to the triathlon tomorrow just to slip my guards for a few hours. Right now, Gibson was kicked back on the couch with Jonah's mother, Jenny, watching some diving competition on TV.
but even my noise-canceling headphones couldn't block out their presence. Gibson was pumping off pissed-off vibes while Jenny was curled into herself. She'd tried to draw him out and was rewarded with the patented Gibson brush-off, a combination grunt and shrug that made it clear he wasn't looking to be friendly. And I was just tired enough of dissecting things to let them both stew. I was tired. Bowie and Cassidy's wedding was tomorrow, the triathlon, the end of summer. I'd scheduled my interview with the doctoral program director for a week after the triathlon. The tension in me was taut like a wire. I wanted to talk to Jonah about us, about the possibility of an us beyond August. But it was hard to have the conversation when we were surrounded by parents and siblings, and between the scare on the bike, the training, and polishing my dissertation, I was exhausted every night. I spared the couch occupants another glance. Gibson had hardly been seen since news broke about Callie's murder. His brothers said he was locked in a shop, but he had shadows under his eyes and a beard that was days beyond well-kept. He'd lost weight as well. Jonah walked in with Billy Ray on his heels. He paused in the doorway. The tension everyone exuded acted as a force field. "Everything okay?" he asked with suspicion. "Just great," I lied, tilting my head in the direction of the couch. A diver on TV executed a perfect maneuver, and neither Gibson nor Jenny reacted. Abruptly, Gibson pushed off the couch and walked past Jonah into the kitchen. He returned with a beer and cracked it open. Jonah and I both watched as he sat back down and guzzled it. Gibson didn't drink. Ever. "Gibbs, what's going on?" Jonah asked. I braced myself for an explosion, a denial.
"Our father's a murdering bastard, and we're all just supposed to be fine with that," he said, his tone flat and dull.
Jenny winced, looking surprised. Jonah opened his mouth to speak, but I shook my head, warning him off.
"He killed a 16-year-old girl who had her whole life ahead of her. We come from that. That's in our blood. He was a monster,"
he spat out, setting the beer down on the end table with a snap.
"How are the sons of monsters supposed to protect someone?"
"Your father didn't kill anyone," she said firmly. Too firmly for it to be parent patronization. I remembered our talk outside the library. How she warned me about taking on men of power, specifically Judge Kendall.
"Oh, God, Jenny," I breathed.
"You know something."
All eyes went to her. Now she looked sick.
"I promise you boys, your father didn't hurt Callie Kendall."
"Mom," Jonah said, his voice low. "What do you know?"
She closed her eyes, rubbed a hand at her forehead.
"I think we're all going to need a drink," she said.
We opened a bottle of whiskey and moved the discussion to the dining room. It felt formal. Gibson stared at the glass in his hand while Jonah and I waited.
"I know your father didn't kill Callie," Jenny said, gaze skating back and forth between Jonah and Gibson.
"Why? Because the drunk son of a bitch told you he didn't?"
Gibson snapped. There was so much pain in his voice that it hurt me to hear it.
"Your father saved Callie Kendall's life."
Gibson was shaking his head already, like he was trying to shake free the hope the words sparked.
"Mom, what are you saying?" Jonah asked.
Jenny took a fortifying sip of whiskey and settled back in her chair.
"Jonah was coming home from a late run to the grocery store."
"You mean the liquor store," Gibson sneered.
Jenny covered his hand with hers, and I watched in surprise when he didn't pull away. Gibson Bodine needed a mom like Jenny, and that just about broke my heart for the man. I reached for Jonah's hand under the table and squeezed.
"The grocery store," she repeated gently. He'd gotten paid for a big job that day and had some money burning a hole in his pocket, so he got steaks for the whole family to grill the next day. Gibson sat stonily, but he was listening. He was on his way home. It was dark. There was this flash of red crumpled up on the side of the road. I held my breath. Gibson pushed away from the table and rose, but didn't go anywhere. It was Callie. She'd been hurt badly. Jonah thought maybe she'd been hit by a car until he got a better look at her. Her face was bruised and cut. There was a lot of blood. She had several cuts on one arm. They looked deep. Gibson's nostrils flared. I fought against the memories that threatened to swallow me. I knew what it was like to be bruised and cut. He took his shirt off and tied it around her arm. Asked if she wanted to go to the hospital or home, she said neither. Asked him to help her get out.
"Who did it?" Gibson demanded. "Who did she say did it?"
She didn't. She refused to tell him. Jonah worried that because she didn't want to go home, that it meant her father had done something. But when he asked her, Callie refused to answer. She begged him to get her out, to help her leave, to save her life. She was shaking, in shock, and terrified. He said he'd never seen anyone so scared in all his life. So he took her to your grandfather's cabin, where you live now. It had been empty for a few years by that point, and he called your mother. Connie called you that night and asked you to take your brothers and sister for the night, remember? Gibson nodded slowly.
I thought they'd had another fight and didn't want anyone around.
She came to the cabin with first aid supplies, and they did what they could to stop the bleeding and clean her up. She was hurt badly, but kept insisting that she needed to get out, that her life depended on it. They believed her, Gibson. So the next day, your father took your mother's car, and he and Callie left town. He drove her to New York, to a friend of Callie's, someone she said she could trust. And then he came home.
None of this makes any sense. Obviously, he didn't save her life. That's still her body they found.
No, it's not, Jenny said firmly.
The dental records matched, Jonah chimed in. They identified the body as hers.
I'm telling you, the dental records are wrong or the report was tampered with. That body is not Callie Kendall's, but someone wants her to stay gone. The hairs on my arms stood at attention.
What proof do you have?
Gibson demanded, his voice breaking. Thoughts whirled around in my brain. Wordlessly, Jenny reached into her purse and pulled out a stack of postcards. She laid them out one by one in front of Gibson. Blue Moon Bend, New York. Buenos Aires. Tokyo. Atlanta, Los Angeles, London, Seattle, Boston. There were 12 in total. The first several were addressed to Jonah Bodine in Bootleg Springs.
I don't understand,
Jonah said.